thanks very much. And I guess it's kind of the height of perversity to begin a whole day devoted to the study of antiquity with a period that really marks its end. It's sort of classically Oxonian, I guess. And particularly because I know that this series of talks is going to end with Bethany Hughes talking about the Bronze Age and Helen of Troy. So you're sort of like Merlin in Sword and Stone, sort of going backwards through time. Because what I want to talk about, as Professor Purcell mentioned, is that's sort of the Berlin Wall, as it's conventionally thought of, which seems to divide classical antiquity from the Muslim world in the Middle East. And it's possibly one of the most rigid sort of categorizations in history. The Cambridge Ancient History, for instance, begins in 602. Muhammad dies in 632. So there's that sort of no man's land between Cambridge Ancient History, Cambridge History of the Muslim world, which really sums up the way in which, I think in most people's heads, you have this idea of the Middle East in the 6th and 7th centuries as occupying radically different frames of reference. Because in the 6th century in the Middle East, you have a world that is still recognisably ancient. The Near East is divided up between two great superpowers. On the one hand, you have the Sasanian Empire, Persian Empire, that to a degree that is what is debated among scholars, but certainly at its foundation seems to consciously hark back to the Achaemenid Empire that was overthrown by Alexander. And that empire in turn, of course, was built on foundations that had been laid by the Babylonians, the Assyrians, ultimately reaching right the way back to the very origins of urban civilization in Mesopotamia. So that's recognisably ancient. And then on the other side, of course, we have what's traditionally called the Byzantine Empire, but as you will all know, is actually a Roman Empire. Rome itself, by this point, of course, has fallen, but we still have an empire that is ruled from the new Rome, the second Rome, Constantinople, albeit that the Romans are now, by and large, talking in Greek. And so, of course, it's an empire that is not only Roman, but is also drawing on the wellsprings of classical Greek civilization. And then on the other hand of this divide, moving into the 7th century, you have the world of Islam. And as I said, the rupture between these two worlds is often felt to be complete. The traditional image of it is that the Arabs come sweeping out of the desert. They've got the Quran in one hand, they've got the sword in the other. And before you can say Allahu Akbar, the conquered provinces of the Persian and the Roman empires have been transformed into a kind of stage set from the Arabian Nights. And the Middle East has suddenly become medieval. It's become Muslim. But just to describe the process as that, of course, is to reveal how inadequate that is as a way of approaching this issue of how transformation expressed itself in the 6th, 7th, and into the 8th centuries in the Middle East. And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this topic here in Oxford is that I owe an immense debt to the scholars of Oxford, because when I was researching this for a book I wrote, I'm very much an independent. I'm not attached to a university. And so it was incredibly useful for me that at Oxford there is an umbrella organisation that devotes itself to the study of late antiquity. And of course it draws on classicists, but it also draws on a whole range of other fields of study here in Oxford, be that Quranic studies, Syriac studies, studies of Persian, of monasticism, of Christianity, of Judaism. And that, of course, is what a great university is about and what it offers, even to those who do not have the honour to be a fellow here, the opportunity to recognise that in fields of study there should be no absolute and hard boundaries. And I feel that this area of study, the question of how the Muslim world emerges from Roman Persian world is a prime example of that. However, in saying that, one has to recognize that this sense of a hard and fast division between the two worlds, between the ancient and the Muslim worlds, remains a fundamental part of people's mental furniture. And I think it's worth asking why that should be. And I think really the answer is pretty simple. And it comes down to the sheer potency of what Muslims have come to believe about the origins of their faith, and which even non-Muslims, right up until really about 30, 40 years ago, I guess, have generally taken for granted. And the story, of course, is an incredibly powerful one. And it says that by the Christian reckoning in AD 610, a merchant named Muhammad, in a cave above a remote and arid city named Mecca, hears something that is as awesome as it is terrifying: the voice of an angel. And what this angel reveals to him is the first in what will become a whole corpus of revelations, which ultimately, gathered together, will constitute the Quran, the foundational scripture of what will emerge to become an entire new religion, Islam. And to Muslims, the divine origin of the Quran is manifest in the circumstances in which it comes into being. It emerges far removed from the world of late antiquity, far removed from the world of the empires and religions that lie to the north in the Fertile Crescent. Now, were you to approach the Quran and not know the story that Muslims tell about how it came into being, if you were oblivious to the traditions that seemingly explain its origin, and you were just to approach the text as you would any other text from the ancient world, I don't think it would be immediately apparent to you that it must have emerged in the depths of Arabia. There are all kinds of pointers to the origin of the Quran in the ferment of ideas and cultures of late antique religion. It's full of characters from the Jewish and Christian Bible, for instance. Moses is mentioned 137 times in the Quran. The Virgin Mary has a greater starring role in it than she does in the New Testament. And there are all kinds of other echoes of Christian martyrology. The Seven Sleepers of Ephesus, for instance, appear. Alexander the Great pops up. But despite this, despite the, as it would seem, on a sort of neutral reading, the very sophisticated relationship between the Quranic text and the world of late antiquity, nevertheless, of course, we are told and we know that Mecca stands at an immense remove from that world. It's 1,000 kilometres from Mecca to the Roman frontier in Palestine. And we are told that it stands in the middle of a desert. We're told, very importantly, that the Muslim sources insist on this, that the inhabitants of Mecca are pagan, so they can't possibly be familiar with these biblical traditions. In Muslim tradition, there are no Jews or Christians in Mecca. And on top of that, we're told, actually in contradiction, it would seem, of the Quranic evidence, but the traditions are absolutely clear about this, we're told that Muhammad himself was illiterate. And all that being so, it then becomes very hard to explain what all these biblical and late antique elements are doing within the Quran when it is so clearly far removed from the late antique context. What can it possibly be except the expression of a bona fide miracle? In other words, it's the story that we are told, the traditional account of the Quran's emergence, suggests that the divine had indeed penetrated this mortal sublunar world of ours. And that, in a way, the interesting parallel is with the traditions that surround the coming of Christ into the world in the Christian story. Because just as it's the blood and muscle of Mary's virgin womb that, in the opinion of Christians, nurtures the coming into the world of Christ, So very similarly, in the opinion of Muslims, it's the sort of the spreading sands of the Arabian desert which had served to preserve the word of God over the course of its protracted delivery in a fit condition of untainted purity. So just to reiterate, if the Muslim traditions that are told about Muhammad and the coming of the Quran into the world are authentic, then it really is very difficult to explain the origins of the Quran except as what Muslims claim it to be, in other words, the supreme miracle in history. However, you will know that the traditions that are told about the emergence of a text, one always has to ask, where do these traditions originate? When do they first appear? And this, of course, is what is so fascinating about the Islamic tradition. When I embarked on researching this period, it's the measure of my naivety that I assumed that there would be a large number of contemporaneous sources, Muslim sources, that would help to explain the origins of this tradition. At the beginning of the book that I wrote, I cheekily quoted Salman Rushdie, who he's talking about, he's contrasting our evidence for the life of Jesus in the Gospels and comparing it with the seemingly vast amount of material that we have on the biography of Muhammad. And he says that we know everything more or less about Muhammad. We know where he lived, what his economic situation was, who he fell in love with. We know what his favourite food was. We know the most intimate details of his relations with his wife. We know how he liked to clean his teeth. This is the kind of detail that you normally get in, you know, the sort of celebrity biographies that come out just before Christmas. But all this seeming wealth of material, which if it's assumed that it's authentic, mean that Muhammad, we know more about Muhammad than we do about anyone else from antiquity. We'd know more about him than Cicero, more about him than Augustine. All this seeming wealth of material, in fact, comes at the earliest 200 years after Muhammad actually lived. From around AD 800, we get the first extant biography of Muhammad that's in the condition that we still have it today. And from that point onward, we get biographies of the Prophet in ever-increasing numbers. And an intriguing detail is that the further in time from Muhammad's life we move, the longer and more detailed these biographies become, which might serve to raise an eyebrow or two. And once again, draws attention to the curious fact that we have no contemporary or even near contemporary biographical materials for Muhammad that were actually written by Muslims. You know, you look for these in the lifetime of the Prophet and a century and more afterwards, and essentially there is nothing. There are no Muslim accounts. What you have instead is a sort of evidential black hole. Now, this black hole has led some scholars, naturally most of them in Germany, because that's where these kind of adventurous theories seem to always, always seem to thrive, to conclude that Muhammad never even existed. That is going way, way too far. In fact, we have quite a lot of evidence that Muhammad existed, but it's not written by Muslims. It's written principally by Christians. For instance, fascinatingly, we have a text written in 634, so very early, which describes an Arab invasion of the Holy Land led by a prophet of the Saracens. And it's hard to know who this prophet of the Saracens could be, if not Muhammad himself. But immediately, this serves to highlight some of the problems that we face, because you remember, Muhammad dies in 632, and yet this is being written in 634 and describing a prophet leading an invasion of the Holy Land, which, according to Muslim tradition, Muhammad didn't, because he'd already died. So there's a sort of interesting knot there. And then after this, over succeeding decades, in the writings of assorted priests and monks, we get allusions to an enigmatic figure, sometimes named as Muhammad, who is described variously as the king or the instructor or the general of the Arabs, although interestingly never as the prophet. But these cryptic allusions, not to mention the fact that they are being made by infidels, once again draws attention to this curious lack of evidence from supposedly self-professing Muslims. And it's only in the 690s, on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, that an Arab ruler finally gets around to putting up an inscription that mentions Muhammad's name. And in the decades that follow that, you start to get the odd private inscription in which Muhammad's name is mentioned, but very, very few. And then over the course of the 8th century, they start to increase. And I think that what this implies is that the emphasis on Muhammad as a prophet is not a bottom-up phenomenon, it's a top-down phenomenon. And then, of course, 800, the floodgates open, we get all kinds of material. Now, there must have been earlier lives of Muhammad, but we just don't have them. And there's a clue as to what might have happened to these earlier accounts of the prophet's life. Actually, in the earliest account that we have, written by a man called Ibn Hisham, who is revising an earlier biography by a man called Ibn Ishaq. And he is absolutely upfront about the process of editing that he has given the materials that he's working with. And he says, things that it is disgraceful to discuss, matters which would distress certain people, and such reports as I have been told are not to be accepted as trustworthy. All these things have I omitted. And that's a kind of honesty. And it enables us to recognise what is of course a crucial factor in this, and explains the difficulty really in making sense of this as source material for the history of the early 7th century, which is that by the early 9th century, so 200 years on, the precise details of what Muhammad might have said or done had come to provide for vast numbers of people from the coast of the Atlantic right up to the frontiers of China with a roadmap that they believed would lead them to heaven. The biographies of Muhammad, the earliest ones, believed that God had seized personal control of human events, that the world had been set upon a novel course, and that therefore no explanation was needed for the emergence of Islam, for the establishment of an Arab empire over the rubble of the Roman and Persian empires that did not ultimately derived from God. Writing in the 10th century, an Arab historian sums this up perfectly. He says, "We went to meet them," that's the Romans and the Persians, "with small abilities and weak forces, and God made us triumph and gave us possession of their territories." And an explanation like that for most Muslim scholars in the 10th century and for most Muslim scholars since then has appeared perfectly adequate. Islam arose because God wanted it to arise. But of course, to historians who are not Muslim, and particularly to those who've been raised in the secular post-Enlightenment tradition of historiography, just saying, well, you know, it happened because God wanted it to happen, not really adequate as an explanation. And so that's why, really over the past 40, 50 years, tied up with Peter Brown's construction of the idea of late antiquity, tied up with various scholars working in the field of Islamic studies. The founding principle of the investigation into the emergence of Islam has come to rely not just on histories or commentaries written by pious Muslims centuries after the events they're describing, but as you would expect from historians, from looking at the sources of the world into which Muhammad was born, and looking at that context, the context of what is traditionally called late antiquity, although in Cambridge, Buhis, Garth Fowden is arguing that we should extend the notion of late antiquity both forwards and backwards from basically the birth of Jesus up to the year 1000. So imperium sine fine. It's, you know, empire building goes on all the time. Now, of course, it is a hugely complex topic to look at this. And that's why, as I said, I found the seminars organised here that really has been sort of looking at these questions so invaluable, because I think not even the greatest scholar could possibly, on his or her own, ever absorb all the areas of research and study that would be necessary to look at this and be absolutely confident that you had mastered every conceivable area that might help you to arrive at a conclusion. But with that caveat in place, I'll just sort of whistle-stop tour through just some of the areas in which I think it makes sense to see the coming of Islam not purely as a clean break with what had gone before, not as a kind of guillotine dropping on the neck of antiquity, but as something else as well, as a bloom sprung from its seedbed. And this is, of course, a sensitive business, because essentially all you're doing is I guess you're sort of doing the equivalent of Peter Wiseman looking at how, I don't know, poems and histories written in the Augustan era, what kind of light that might shed on the historicity of the, you know, of early Rome. And angry Romans are not going to get cross about him if he says that he doesn't believe in Romulus or, you know, Horatius on the bridge. People are not going to get cross about that. But this is an area that is, you know, there are many, many sensitivities that surround it. And so I think with that in mind, I'll begin not with the religious dimensions of the replacement of the Roman and Persian empires by an Arab one, but with the geopolitical ones. And as I said, the traditional narrative has the Arabs erupting from the sort of the depths of the desert. And these are warriors who are pristine, who are pure, who are untainted by any contact with the corrupt desert. And this is the kind of mythology that, of course, feeds into you know, all the people who are on Twitter and taking selfies and uploading footage of themselves from their cell phones in Syria, all the fighters from the West, that they are casting themselves as people who have cast off, you know, have nothing to do with the corrupt decadence of today's empire. So very similarly, you know, they are drawing on this mythology of the idea that the first Arabs, the first Muslims were uncorrupted, had no point of contact with the Roman and the Persian worlds. But this is not true. The Arabs were very, very much a part of the Roman and the Persian worlds. And in fact, one of the reasons that first made me so interested in this topic was, I guess, was what I call the Peter Heather theory as to why the Roman Empire fell, which I'm sure you all know, but the idea, in other words, that on the Rhine frontier and the Danube, what the Romans did to essentially to sort of pacify these pestiferous tribesmen who lived beyond the frontier, beyond the border, was essentially to bribe them to behave. And the accumulation of gold, of wealth, of military experience, and of the example of Roman statehood over the course of the centuries gradually Romanized these tribesmen on the frontiers, so that by the, you know, in the 5th century, when the Roman Empire went through one of its periodic bouts of implosion, these barbarian tribal entities were sufficiently strong to move in and take over. And this seemed to me, you know, one of the questions that I asked when I began this was, well, did something similar happen with the Arabs? And on one level, yes, because the Romans in Syria and Palestine, and indeed the Persians in Mesopotamia, faced an identical problem, that the Arabs were not worth the effort of conquering, but they were a constant nuisance. And so in a very similar way, Arab tribesmen were indeed employed as mercenaries, and over time these scattered tribes did indeed come to constitute quite coherent kingdoms. But having said that, the Arabs, of course, were never... their states were never on the scale of the ones beyond the Rhine, simply because the desert cannot sustain that number of people. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why when the empire in the West collapsed, it carried on in the East. And of course, in the 6th century, it, particularly under Justinian, it looks as though it's really going to make a comeback. I mean, in many ways, Justinian's reign is cast as one of the termini of classical antiquity, because he closes the philosophical schools in Athens. But as you know, I now know that the Oxford Classics Faculty has closed philosophy and it remains a classics faculty. Very similarly, Justinian's world remained a Roman one, and it adopted very Roman policies of conquest and punishment of those who had dared to usurp Roman prerogatives. And so under Justinian, you know, Roman armies reconquer North Africa, reconquer Sicily, reconquer Italy. They get footholds in Spain. Triumphs are held in the Hippodrome. You know, it looks, Rome is back. But then you get a series of calamities which, in the Muslim accounts of how Islam emerges, simply do not register. But to anyone looking at the history of the 6th and 7th century, must loom out at you as absolute, you know, as events that are fundamental to the history of the 7th century as the First and Second World Wars were to the history of the second half of the 20th century. And the first of these series of catastrophes breaks out in 541, and it is a terrible plague, the Justinianic plague. Understandably, historians are very nervous of the idea that you can, of catastrophism, of the idea that some sudden catastrophe can in any way affect the course of history. But one of the really interesting things that has happened, you know, is ongoing, is an increasing understanding of what exactly the Justinianic plague was. And it seems that it was indeed bubonic, which implies that its impact on a population that would have had absolutely no experience of it at all might well have been even worse than that of the Black Death. And it suggests that when contemporaries describing its impact say that a third, a half of the world died, you know, they may not actually have been exaggerating that badly. And it is a particular problem for the Romans, because the Roman world remains an urban one. And of course, the impact of plague on cities is disproportionately greater than that on people living out in the deserts. And this was noted at the time. There was one Roman commander who commented rather nervously that the empire's own once countless military units have dwindled in number, but the plague, that ally of war, has not so much as touched the rancorous tribes. And the result is a pronounced shift in the balance of power, because the effect of the plague is not only to devastate Roman reserves of manpower, and you're having incredible descriptions of tribes coming in through the Balkans and going past cities that have just been left abandoned. There's just no one to stop them. But it also devastates the tax base. And so Justinian, in the second half of his reign, is faced with a sort of need to impose an austerity program that would make George Osborne's eyes water. And one of the ways in which he imposes austerity is essentially to close down the Syrian-Palestine frontier. He sort of mothballs all the forts that line it, and these forts get abandoned to jackals and to weeds and the odd eccentric hermit. And he essentially franchises out the defense of this frontier to, you've guessed it, these Arab tribes, these sort of proto-kingdoms, indeed kingdoms in many cases. So that's not looking good. And then it gets worse. Because at the beginning of the 7th century, the ancient world's equivalent of the Black Death is followed up by its equivalent of the First World War. Because the Cold War that had been sort of rumbling on between the Roman and the Persian empires for centuries erupts into an absolutely devastating conflict. And the war between the Romans and the Persians convulses the whole of the Middle East for decades. And even though it is the Romans who ultimately emerge triumphant, it's by the skin of their teeth. Persian armies reach right the way up to the walls of Constantinople, and the provinces of Syria, of Palestine, of Egypt are swallowed up by Persian armies for a decade or more. And the Persian king, Khosrow II, establishes a broader sway of Persian imperium than any that had existed since the time of the Achaemenids. And so that means that those Arabs who had been manning the frontier for the Romans have been cut off from their supply of gold. Caesar is no longer on hand to pay them. And so they too are embroiled in this process of convulsion and seeming collapse that is afflicting the Fertile Crescent. So plague, war, poverty. They too are being affected by this. And it goes without saying that this is a period in which everyone takes for granted that what is happening in the world reflects the will of God. And so you get people everywhere, no matter what their religious affiliation, whether they are Christian hermits, whether they are Zoroastrian mobeds, whether they are rabbis, looking to the heavens and saying, well, what the hell is going on here? What does God want? What have we got to do? And I think that it is a reasonable question to ask, well, is the Quran perhaps a record of a very similar search for meaning? And it's not immediately obvious that this is the case, because as I said, firstly, Muslim tradition separates the emergence of the Quran from the convulsions of what is going on in the Fertile Crescent during the lifetime of Muhammad. But it's also because the Quran is not like the Bible. It does not have conveniently datable figures like Cyrus or Augustus mentioned in its pages. In fact, there's only one sort of geopolitical entity that is mentioned in the Quran. That's the Romans. Single verse, and it says, "The Romans have been defeated in a nearby land, and yet after their defeat they shall be victorious in a few years." And it would seem likely that this is a reference to the defeat of the Romans in Palestine. That's what it's most people assume it is. Are there other clues, perhaps, that would suggest a context of the great Roman-Persian War? Well, I think there is. I think there's a particularly intriguing one in the fact that Alexander, as I said, is mentioned. He's not called Alexander. He's not mentioned by name, but he's called Dulcanane, which means the horned one. And, of course, an immediate echo of those coins of Alexander showing the horns of Amun. So, I mean, that's the sort of intriguing thought that in the Quran, the horns of Amun seem to get a name check. But what is fascinating about this is that the account of Dulcanane, he goes to the ends of the world. He walls up Gog and Magog, who are barbarous tribesmen so savage that they think nothing of snacking on kittens, walls them up behind gates of iron where they will stay until the end of days. And all these details appear in a Syrian story that is written against the backdrop of the Roman fight back against the Persians, which is led by, if you wanted the title Last of the Romans, maybe you would give it to this emperor, Heraclius, who leads the fight back. He has a pagan name, despite being a very devout Christian. He sails to the rescue of the Roman Empire from Carthage. He leaves Constantinople under siege by the Persians and leads a sort of crack, strips the churches to fund one last attempt to defeat the Persians, leads a crack squad into Mesopotamia, and in the most extraordinary fight back, the most extraordinary reversal, I think, in military history, brings the Persians and the Persian king to the negotiating table and essentially wins it for New Rome. Hooray! And one of the key terms is, first of all, that the Persians have to withdraw from Palestine and Syria and Egypt, but also that they have to return the greatest piece of loot that had been plundered by the Persians, the greatest treasure in the Christian world, the true cross, which the mother of Constantine, of course, had found in Jerusalem and had been in Jerusalem ever since. And Heraclius takes the true cross from Persia himself, escorts it through Syria, through Palestine to Jerusalem, and it's the greatest day of his life, returns it. God has obviously blessed him. And the Syrian story obviously models its account of Alexander, who, of course, like Heraclius, had struck east and conquered the Persians. The two are clearly, Alexander is clearly representing Heraclius. And the Alexander in this story is a Christian who is praying to God and says that he is going to take his throne back to Jerusalem, set it up there, ready for the second coming of Christ. And he is taking this throne in the same way that Heraclius is taking the cross back to Jerusalem. And this is the story that then appears in the Quran, and it seems to be drawing on it and to be reflecting on the sort of swirl of Roman propaganda that surrounds Heraclius's return of the true cross. Except that it has been stripped of anything that might suggest Christian or Roman propaganda. No mention of that. And the reason for that is perfectly clear, that in the Quran, the very notion of great empires, of world powers, are as nothing. They are just grains of sand blown on a desert wind. For every nation there is an appointed span of time, it says in the Quran. When their time arrives, they can neither delay it nor bring it forward, even for an instant. So I think that although the clues inevitably are sketchy, I think that they do suggest that the Quran in the form that we have it now was indeed uttered by someone, presumably Muhammad, in the period that Muslim tradition has always insisted that he lived. So I think that that's a kind of, there we have a solid basis on which to start constructing maybe other areas of research. And of course begs the obvious question, well, does that prove that everything that Muslim tradition says about Muhammad and the origins of the Quran are accurate? Well, there remains this familiar problem, which is that how, if what the biographies of Muhammad tell us are true, and Mecca is an inveterately pagan city, devoid of any Jewish or Christian presence, situated in the midst of a vast untenanted desert, how are we to account for the appearance there of a fully fledged biblical monotheism, complete with references to Abraham, to Moses, to Jesus, except as a miracle? And of course, that's fine if you're a Muslim. If you're not, you've got to you've got to find some explanation for this. And there is, I think, a sense in which non-Muslim Western accounts of the beginnings of Islam have kind of sort of revolved around this question. And most of the theories about the life of Muhammad, the career of Muhammad, the context in which he operated, are basically drawing on this. And I suppose the most popular, the best known one, is that that Mecca is on the spice trail leading from the south of Arabia Felix, up to Syria, and that Muhammad is a merchant, and that he goes up to Syria and he picks up sort of garbled references to Jewish and Christian tradition. Two big problems with this thesis, though. One is Mecca wasn't on the spice train. It was 100 miles to the left. And of course, the spice train by this point was not really particularly flourishing anyway. It, declined with the coming of Christianity. And secondly, it supposes that the relationship of Muhammad to Jewish and Christian tradition is kind of analogous to that of a student going to India in his gap year and then coming back with a Ganesh statue. I mean, and the problem with that is that, as I've said, the relationship of the Quran to Jewish and Christian tradition is actually incredibly sophisticated, because it's evident that not only Muhammad himself, but his opponents as well, are very familiar with the Jewish and Christian prophets and patriarchs. The Quran, an incredibly disputatious book, chiefly consists of God and his prophet arguing with, rather like a Cicero speech, actually, where, you get Cicero's side, but you've got no idea, you have to work out what Cicero's opponent is saying purely from Cicero's own account. So similarly, you have to work out what the prophet's opponents are saying from his own account. But it's clear that when he talks about Abraham or Jesus, he is taking for granted that his opponents will know what he's talking about. And so therefore it suggests that the Muslim tradition, which says that these people, these opponents, are the mushrikin, as they're called, are inveterately pagan, cannot be true. And the oddest thing of all, really, is that a lot of what is within the Quran, the Jewish and Christian material, is actually very ancient. you know, this is a period which is an incredibly vital, indeed tumultuous one in Christian theology. You've got all kinds of Monophysites and Nestorians and Chalcedonians all furiously debating what the natures of Christ are and what their relationship might be within his divine person. But there's no reflection of this. The debate within the Quran about the nature of Christ is a much older one, going right, you know, back before Arius, right the way back to the Gospel of Basilides and those sort of Gnostic traditions of Christ having been either purely human or having watched someone else replace him on the cross. And these are traditions that in the world of the Orthodox Roman Empire had basically vanished. You know, these Gospels had vanished into the rubbish dumps of Egypt, and they wouldn't be found there until very much later, but there they are, sort of preserved like coelacanths in the great ocean of the Quranic text. And you have all kinds of other, you know, you have Coptic Gospels, you have echoes of Jewish apocalyptic traditions. You even, according to some scholars, have trace elements of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is again completely fascinating because obviously Dead Sea Scrolls were not were not around at that time. To wonder what are they doing there, and I think that what it suggests is that maybe, you know, a stimulating analogy in looking forward to what Bethany will be talking about is actually with Homer, and you know, Homer in a sense, you know, Homer is, to what extent does it make sense to think of Homer as the author of the Iliad? In one sense he is, in one sense obviously he isn't, because the traditions are much older, and I think that it's very interesting to think of Muhammad perhaps in an analogous relationship to the Quran, that in one sense clearly the prophetic utterances within the Quran are associated with him for whatever reason, but at the same time they clearly draw on traditions and in many cases phrases and passages of poetry and legislation that are much older than him. And so what I think that suggests is that the Quran, far from being a sort of radical new beginning, although in some sense that's what it becomes, of course, it does make sense to think of it as a sort of great ocean into which all kinds of streams from all different kinds of sources are flowing, and those, you know, those waters are merging and mixing and creating something that will shake the world. Now, it's all very well to say that, but of course, that then presupposes that the Quran is indeed emerging from a milieu in which these various constituent elements might plausibly mix and meet within the Quranic text. And how do you solve that problem when Muslim tradition says, well, it emerges in Mecca with a load of pagans? Any solution to this must be conjectural, because the traditional Muslim account is the only narrative account that we have. We have no other account. So you are immediately plunged into the world of conjecture. But again, with that caveat in place, the solution to the puzzle that seems likeliest to me is that the origin of the Quran lies well to the north of the place that is now called Mecca, along the desert borders of Palestine, so northern Arabia, around the region of Petra. The Quran, of course, bears witness to, seems to, the war between the Romans and the Persians. That verse, you know, the Romans have been defeated in a nearby land, nearby. But I think it also bears witness to the unique role that Palestine, the Christian Holy Land, has in the world of the late Roman Empire, which is, of course, that it gets transformed by Constantine's conversion from, out of the way backwater into one of the, you know, the most important place in the world. And Christians and Jews, of course, still come from across the empire there. And most of these, as a notion of Christian orthodoxy evolves in the wake of Nicaea, are happy to subscribe to the tenets of Nicaea and to the tenets of Christian Roman orthodoxy. But there are also plenty who don't. There are Jews who believe that Christ is the Messiah. There are Christians who believe that you should follow the Mosaic Law. There are Samaritans. There are all kinds of people with different views and different perspectives different takes on Jewish and Christian tradition that increasingly come to be branded as heretical. And as they get branded heretical, so they get pushed to the margins. And very difficult to trace this, but we can trace, for instance, the movement of a group called the Ebionites, who are kind of sort of anti-Pauline Christians, Jewish Christians, Judeo-Christians. And they get pushed from the region of Galilee up to the Golan Heights, and then we're told that they go out into the desert, and there, of course, they vanish. But I think that if you were saying what one region in the world might there have been in the sort of late 6th, early 7th century, which preserved like a kind of Jurassic Park, otherwise prehistoric, you know, otherwise vanished and extinct traditions, I think you would say probably the desert regions beyond Palestine would be the likeliest place. You know, which is all well and good, except you still have this problem about Mecca, because Mecca is, of course, not on the margins of Palestine. And again, I think the solution to this puzzle lies in looking at the Quran, not just in the context of what the commentaries and the traditions and the Muslim scholarly apparatus tells us, but trying to sort of strip all that away, get rid of all the scaffolding and the cladding, and look at it as a text that might have been written in the 7th century, and what does that tell us? And what it tells us, actually, is that Mecca is not significant in the Quran. There's one ambiguous mention of it, a place called Mecca, which might refer to, you know, the kind of great, the Dubai of its day that it's traditionally cast as in so many histories. But it might just as well be a village, it might just as well be, in fact, it's probably the consensus is that it's referring to a valley. And otherwise, the fascinating, and I found it extraordinary thing, is that in the whole vast corpus of ancient literature, there isn't a single datable mention of Mecca anywhere until 742. And even then, it's located in the deserts that lie beyond Iraq. So the Christian chronicler who is writing about Mecca clearly has no idea where it is. And it suggests that it's maybe analogous to, I don't know, something like Camelot, that it sort of floats around and pops up in sort of various places until finally it gets solidly located in the place that we now have it. And if you look in the Quran itself, there are all kinds of pointers to the fact that it can't be where Mecca is now. The opponents of the Prophet, the Mushrikin, are described as keeping cattle. Quran is gets very hot under the collar about sort of treating cattle in the wrong way. God gets very cross about this. They tend vines, they grow olives. You cannot keep cattle in Mecca, there's no water. You certainly can't grow the Mediterranean olive there, which was the only one available to people in that period. You know, it's a Mediterranean crop. So all kinds of problems there. And the difficulty with this, of course, is that as with history, so with topography, there are very few definite place names. There are only 9 places mentioned in the Quran, and only one of those, Yathrib, the future Medina, we definitely know where it is. All the others sort of float around hazily. But there does seem to be one topographical pointer within the Quran, which is very interesting. And fittingly, it draws on biblical tradition. It draws on the Genesis story of Lot. And specifically Lot's wife, you know, who turns around and gets turned into a pillar of salt. And in the Quran, this is God speaking, he says, "Remember when we delivered Lot and all his household except for an old woman who was left behind? Then we destroyed the others. You pass by them morning and night. Will you not understand?" So you pass by them morning and night. Now, we know in late antiquity where people believed that Sodom, the place where Lot had escaped, stood, and it stood in the southernmost point of the Dead Sea. And we know that because Christians had built a place of pilgrimage in the cave where Lot was meant to have sheltered. And so that suggests that, if the verse is to be taken as gospel, it must be the place that where the Mushrikin, the opponents of the Prophet, lived, was reasonably close to where the site of Sodom was believed to be in late antiquity. And it's when scholars try and group Judaism, Christianity, and Islam together, the popular sort of group category is Abrahamic religion. And I think that that's a perfectly reasonable one. But when you look at where were Abrahamic myths based in late antiquity, and they were very important for Jews, for Christians, for Samaritans, for all kinds of people within the Christian Holy Land, they're all in that area. They're all in Palestine and in the deserts that lie beyond Palestine. There is no tradition at all that links them with the Hejaz and with Mecca whatsoever. And of course, those Abrahamic myths of late antiquity are part of the great swirl of broader antique currents, the currents that saw classical influences, Persian influences, Jewish influences merge and blend. You know, they're there in Justinian's laws, in patristics, in Talmudic scholarship. And I think that they are there in Islam as well. And I think that what's really fascinating is that the Quran, far from standing at some fantastical remove from the currents and convulsions of the age, in fact is the precise opposite. I think it's in many ways the supreme monument to them. So, woohoo, classics conquers Islam. Thank you very much.